So we are in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, this beautiful chapter called Vibhuti Yoga or Divine Glories of the Lord. We know the Lord is glorious and He's wonderful and exalted and beautiful, all these qualities we associate with the Lord. But in this particular chapter, in response to the student's question that, O Lord, I know You are everywhere and I know You are everything. Because in the 7th, 8th and 9th chapter, the Lord had said, I am the substratum, I am the support, I am the formless consciousness. So He says that is very difficult. And for most of us, at least for me, it is very hard for us to contemplate the Lord upon as the formless substratum of the whole universe, all-pervading, cannot be described, cannot be seen, cannot be thought of. You know, those are the things they use to describe Brahman, the consciousness that is beyond the senses, it's beyond the mind, it is beyond the intellect. It is the light of consciousness that illumines my consciousness and all of everybody else. Everybody is illumined by that one light of consciousness indicated here as Om. It does not have a form, does not have a name, does not have a description. And so for most of us beginners, it becomes very difficult. And so the student asks the teacher, how am I to see You? You know, for me, don't tell me You are formless. Don't tell me You are all-pervading. Like there is, reminds me of a little story. You know, the gopis, these were these cowherd women of Vrindavan. And they loved Krishna because Krishna was living amongst them. And, you know, taking care of the cows, and he grew up there, and everybody loved him because he was so sweet and so delightful. And the gopis not only loved him as a child, as a baby, but also they could see the divinity in him. And so their love for him was divine, was a pure love. And so when Krishna left and went to Mathura, you know, he had other things to do, other missions to accomplish, and he was gone, and the gopis were really missing him, and they were so sad because it was like the part of their heart had been pulled out, and they were all the time missing him and worried about him. And so Krishna had a friend, his name was Uddhav, who was with him in Mathura. And this Uddhav was very arrogant because he had studied Vedanta, he had studied chapter 9 of the Bhagavad Gita and all the Upanishads. And he said, God is all pervading, all everywhere, all consciousness. You know, these forms of the Lord, you know, you don't need to worship the form because He's all formless. Yeah, at the highest level He is, but for beginners, it's not that easy. And so Krishna wanted to teach him a lesson. So he says, you know what? You are very right. You know, God is all pervading. He's all formless. And there are these gopis, these simple women who are living in Gokul, and that's why our place is called Gokul, because Krishna grew up there. And they live there and they're really missing Me, you know, because they see Me as the Lord, and they are very sad, and they are very, he said, I'll go and teach them that God is everywhere. Why do you have to worry about Krishna as a form? He's there in the tree, He's there in the rock. So I'll go and teach them. So that way they won't be missing You, they won't be crying. So Krishna said, yes, please go. So he goes there and says, you know, you are unnecessarily crying for Krishna. They say, why? He says, you know, He is everywhere. He is that all-pervading consciousness. And he says, you know, you need to give up this and put your heart in loving all beings and love all things. And he says, then they make two or three comments. They say, Udho man nahi das bees. I don't have 10 or 20 minds. I have only one mind, one heart. And ek ho to gayo samsang. That one mind I have is already gone with Krishna. I don't have any other mind. I don't have anything. I can't love anything else. And you're telling me to love everything. Whatever I had is all gone with the Lord. So that kind of love. And then they said, you know, this manifest, where does He live? Can you show us? Can you show us where does He live? How does He function? How does He walk? We have seen Krishna. We know where He lives. We know how He walks. We know how He talks. So they had this pure love for Him, and He was, and then as they were talking, tears were flowing down from their eyes because of the divine love. And then He immediately understood His mistake. He says, I was talking about the formless and all, but here I can see true love for the Lord, selfless love and complete devotion, where they say that since Krishna has gone, I cannot think of anything else. I cannot see anything else. I mechanically I go to my farm and I milk my cows and I think of him. When I am cooking for my children, I think of him. When I am, you know, going to bed, I'm thinking of him. So the idea being that that kind of profound love for the Lord is very hard to find. And he immediately realized his mistake. He says, who am I trying to teach? They can teach me so much. And his arrogance vanished and he bent down and touched their feet. Because he said, this is where you see true love for the Lord. So the idea being not that one is inferior or one is superior. All paths lead to the Lord. But in the beginning, it is easier to love form God as a particular form, whether it's Jesus or it is Krishna or Shiva or Mother Goddess or whatever form. And then from there, you then transfer your love to that all-pervading formless, because he is both form and formless and he's beyond. Because form and formless are just concepts of the intellect. He's beyond all concepts, the true consciousness. And then you start seeing him in all forms. Not only I see him in Jesus, but I see him equally in Krishna, Shiva, you know, Mother Goddess, Buddha. And then I see him in all beings, all creatures, all animals, plants, birds, and fish. Even in the inanimate objects. And I also see him in me as life. So that is the evolution of thought. And so here, Krishna is showing us how you can see me as the Lord in all things, everywhere. You can see me in the mountains, you can see me in the birds, you can see me in the animals, in the fish, and among all the, you know, people and all. And so that is why he says that in all of them, I am the best. So when you see anything glorious, anything beautiful, you see me. So that is the idea being that when you see something beautiful, you see somebody singing very well, you say, ah, that's the Lord singing. You see some good piece of poetry or some great scientific breakthrough. You know, somebody came up with a great invention, you know, where they discovered gravity or the law of relativity or whatever. So anything that you see brilliant, you see the Lord. So these examples are, each of them is can be a focus of meditation. That when I'm sitting, I can focus on that among all the lights, I am the sun. So then I, you know, remember the sun. Among the night, I am the moon. So you think about the, you know, all the stars and that glorious full moon shining. So the idea being that any of these examples can become a goal for you to meditate. So we'll do verse number 34, where we will get a few more examples. Mrityu sarvaharaschaham. Udbhavascha bhavishyatam, Kirti Shrivakcha Narinam, Smritir Medha Dhritikshama. So Mrityu Sarva Harashchaham. Hara means that which takes away. So that which takes away something from us is called a hara. That's why one of the Lord's name is also Hari. Why do we call the Lord as Hari? We'll talk about that. So that which takes away something. So Mrityu is the final taker, because it takes everything from us. Takes away our body, takes away our near and dear ones, our friends, relatives, everything is taken away by death. So he says, among all the takers, I am death. So the idea being that death is the final leveler. Swamiji in his commentary says, whether you are young or old, whether you are rich or poor, whether you are king or a commoner or whatever you are, whether you are animal, bird, or plant, or fish, but death is the great leveler. It makes everybody equal. Once you go under the ground or once you are cremated, everybody is equal. You say, well, why does God say I am death? Because death is required, as we have talked here many times. If there was no death, then, you know, the earth would be overpopulated. All our grandfathers, great-grandfathers and would be still living. The dinosaurs would still be populating the earth and there would be no space. So death is needed for new creation, for space to be made. Not only that, all creation is a process of creation and destruction, like the seed is there. Now the seed dies for the plant to come out. So you say, why did the poor seed have to die? Well, if they didn't die, the plant wouldn't have come out. And then the plant has beautiful flowers, and then the flowers die. You say, oh, why did the poor flower die? It was so pretty. But then the flower gave birth to the fruit. So then the fruit comes, and then you destroy the fruit. And you say, why did the fruit die? Because then the seed had to come out. And from that seed, again you plant, and again the tree starts. So everything is a process of birth and death. Just as childhood dies for you to become a youth, your childhood has to die. For youth to become middle age, to become old age, is a process of birth and death. Day has to die for night to be born. Otherwise, if there was always day, then you would not be able to sleep. And then night has to die for birth to be born. So there is a constant creation and dissolution. So he says, I am the death. Hari, also God's name is called Hari because he is the one that steals away my ignorance. They say you surrender to the Lord. Lord, I am yours. And you steal away, take away. And that's what he does. He takes away our ignorance. He takes away our pride. Takes away our, you know, sense of separation from him. And that is what separates me from the Lord, is this foolish notion that I am the doer. I am this wonderful person. I can do so much. So when that goes away, when that ego goes away, then the Lord alone is there. And that's what we find in the lives of these great saints. They had absolutely no ego. Look at the life of Jesus or Mahatma Gandhi, or, you know, I mean, all these, you know, Tukaram and all these, Mirabai. They had absolutely no ego. They had absolutely no sense of they were one with the Lord. They were very humble, very modest, and they accomplished so much. You know, even thousands of years from now, people will always remember these great, you know, great saints and all. So that's why he says, I am the great stealer. I am the Hari. I take away everything, and I ultimately, and the idea of death, because death is, people have this fear, you know, death is this terrible thing, and when somebody dies, we feel sad, and then when my own time comes, you know, and doctor tells me you have cancer and you only have 3 months or 6 months to live, then I get very depressed. But we find that throughout history, all great people have looked for a way to go beyond death. Buddha, when he went out with the chariot, he saw people dying and people sick and people getting old. And he asked him, does everybody go like that? He said, yes, your highness, you also will become old and become sick and die. And he said, I don't want to die. I want to find the path beyond death. And he did. Buddha found through nirvana that he is actually that immortal self through his meditation. And that is the goal of spirituality, because we all think that we are this limited body, and then I have this mind and intellect, so when I die, I am finished. This body dies, and then I don't know what happens to my thoughts, and I'm gone. But Vedanta tells us that you are that immortal self. You are deathless. You are birthless. In the second chapter, Sri Krishna says that the self that you are cannot be, fire cannot burn it, weapons cannot cut it. So nothing can actually destroy you, because you are that deathless self. In the Kathopanishad, which, you know, we have this translation in the office, Nachiketa, that young boy, goes to the Lord Death himself, goes to Lord Death Yamaraja, and says, I want to know how I can go beyond death. You're going to death and asking him how I can go beyond death? And the teacher realizes that this boy's search is genuine, and he teaches him the path of fire and the path of how one can, while living in this body itself, realize that I am that deathless. And then once that happens, then death has no fear for such a person. You can crucify him, you can burn him, you can kill him, you can do whatever, because he becomes fearless. Because in reality, all of us are that deathless substratum, that om, that consciousness, but we do not know that. And so the goal of spirituality is to know it, experience it, and live it. So So become deathless, become fearless. So that is why he says, I am death. Udbhavash cha bhavishyatam. Here there are two translations. One is that I am prosperity among the prosperous. I don't think that fits very well. The second meaning, where bhavishyatam means bhavishya, we all know, means the future. Udbhava means the creation. So I am what will be. I am that now which will be something in the future, which the Lord means I am the substratum of all the creation. Whatever is, I am, and whatever will be in the future, I am. And whatever was in the past, I am also, because he talks about death. So the idea being that I am the past, present, and future, and I am the support of all of them. When the pot is made, the mud is not, mud is modified, but nothing happens to the mud. And then the pot breaks, still nothing happens to the mud remains unchanged. So similarly, I am the consciousness from which all creation and sustenance and dissolution happens. So I am the creation and I am the death. Then he says, I am Kirti Shri. Here I have the meanings. I think everybody can read them. Kirti means fame. Shri means prosperity. Vak is speech. Smriti, memory. Medha, intelligence. Dhriti, fortitude. And Kshama means forgiveness and patience. So he says, I am the Narinam. Among the feminine qualities, I am all of these. So what does he mean by among the feminine qualities? Does that mean that these qualities are only there in women? No, what he means actually in our language is nouns can be male or female. Even the inanimate objects are given, like maize, is female. Table is a male, but kursi is a female, but farash, floor, is a male. So everything is given either a feminine or a negative. Like shakti, power is feminine, but bala is masculine. Usme bahut bal hai. So bala is masculine and shakti is feminine. So the idea being that all nouns are, there are either masculine or feminine. In fact, in Sanskrit, they also have neuter, masculine, feminine, and neuter. Like the word phalam, fruit, is neuter. So the nouns can be either masculine, can be feminine, or can be neuter. And this reminds me of somebody was trying to study Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, phalam is fruit, but any noun has a singular and a plural. Like you can say one table and many tables, right? So in English, it is very simple. Table and tables, box and boxes, hat and hats. It's very simple. But in Sanskrit, it's not like that. The singular is different, the two is different, and the multiple is different. So phalam, the fruit, can be phalam is one, two is called phale, and three is called phalani. So any noun has three forms. One, if there is one of that, it is called something else. Two of that is called something else. Multiple is called something else. So one poor student was confused. He says, phalam phale phalani, Sanskrit kadina ani. He says, this phalam phale phalani, I'm tired of that. I'll never be able to learn Sanskrit. And it's Sanskrit, that's why it is a difficult language, because every noun has three forms. And then not only that, but nouns can be masculine, can be feminine, can be neuter. And so people get highly confused. But when you actually study the depth of it, I actually don't know that much Sanskrit, but whatever little I have studied, is such a sweet language. And the flow is so sweet because of sandhis. There are no harsh words. There are no abrupt cutoffs. And the verses flow very smoothly. So here, the reason he's saying, I am the feminine qualities, because these qualities are, of course, in the Sanskrit language, called feminine qualities, like Kirti, Shri, Vak, Smriti. But then there are, of course, masculine qualities like Teja, brilliance and all. But the idea is that, A, I am everything that is good. So the point being that God is not only in male, he's not only male. People say, God is male, you know, that's why he favors the men, and poor women have all the problems and they have to bear the children. No, it's not like that. It is the consciousness. It is the substratum. And so he's equally there in male and females. In fact, this whole universe came about because of the combination of male and female, whether it's plants or whether it's birds or fish or animals or humans. All growth and multiplication happens when male and female work together. Males cannot exist by themselves. Females cannot exist by themselves. Similarly, this whole universe is said to be a combination of Prakriti and Purush. So Purush symbolizes spirit and Prakriti symbolizes matter. So spirit, which is symbolized as male, cannot function if there was no matter. Spirit alone cannot function. And then matter, of course, needs spirit to illuminate. Like electricity, if there was only electricity, but there was no bulb, there was no fan, then obviously electricity would be useless. It would just be circulating in the building, but not able to do anything. On the other hand, if there is a fan and there is a light, but there is no power, then it's no good either. So just as light can only come with a combination of electricity and fan, so similarly the world can only be created with a combination of matter and spirit. So here he says, I am the feminine qualities. In fact, in our religion, God is symbolized as Ardhanarishwara. Ardhanarishwara. So what it means that if you look at, there's a particular form of, interesting form of Lord Shiva, where he's actually half man and half woman. The right side is man and the left side is woman, and they actually have those statues and in some of the temples, symbolizing that men and women are best not when they compete, but when they complete each other. Swami Chinmayananda used to say they should, in a marriage or in a family, man and woman should complete each other, not compete. So that is the reason he says, I am the feminine qualities. We'll just talk briefly about the feminine qualities. Kirti. Kirti means fame. And fame means fame that is good, not fame that is evil. Now, you know, in fact, in Hindi, there is a line which says, Badnaam bhi huye to kya naam na hoga. And it says, even if I get infamous and I become a criminal, but at least I'll be famous. You know, people will know me. People will remember me. When he says fame, it means the fame of Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln or John F. Kennedy, fame of people who have done good for us, who have done good for the world. So I am that fame, good fame, not the infamous. Shri, he says, I am Shri. Shri means the prosperity. Shri we always translate as wealth, and people say, wealth I want. You know, everybody wants. But that wealth is only temporary. Yeah, it will be there for a while, and of course you need it and you'll enjoy it, but the more important is the inner wealth. And if we look at a person, we admire him for who he is rather than what he has. What he has for a while he may impress us, but if the person has a lot, but he's a crook, he's very dishonest, he's a criminal, he's not kind, he's not loving, then we don't want to know such a person. So he says, I am the inner wealth of good qualities, of wisdom and love, compassion. So he says, I am the inner wealth. I am the inner wealth of good qualities, love, compassion, kindness, you know, all those qualities. That's where you find the Lord. When you see somebody exhibiting these qualities of love, kindness, that's where you say, oh, the Lord resides in his heart. Then I'm speech. Again, speech, you know, obviously it is all our, represents all our abilities, the ability to speak, the ability to communicate, and not only speech, but all this also represents the ability to walk, talk, all the motor activities. I am. And memory. Obviously, memory is such an amazing thing. You're in the middle of something, and suddenly something you have remember studied years back, many, many years back, it comes out. And actually, it happens to me sometimes when I'm sitting here. I don't know what power works, but somebody will ask me a question, and something that I had read or studied from Swamiji years back and had never even thought about, how it appears, you know, it's amazing. It is that Lord functioning through. So he says, I am memory. I am anything that you remember. You know, even sometimes you say, I remember my childhood, you know, when I was used to run around and my village and my little house where I grew up. So he says, I am the memory. Then he says, Medha, I am the intelligence. And that is true, because anything that is intelligent, and we find that man has been able to do so much. Animals, you know, the monkey is still the same. Even he was the same even, you know, 10,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago. Dogs were still running around. Giraffes were still eating leaves. But men have progressed, where now we can build our homes. We have gone into space. We have split the atom. So that is intelligence. That is who I am. And they say that if you want to improve your intelligence, you know, there is, of course, two things, two particular verses in our scriptures. One is the Gayatri Mantra, and the Gayatri everybody knows, and he'll talk about Gayatri, so I'll cover that in the next verse. But chanting the Gayatri Mantra gives you great intelligence when you chant it with devotion and love, because it is the Lord within that improves the memory. And also there is a Medha Suktam, there is a particular verse in our scriptures, in the Upanishads, totally devoted to Medha. How by chanting that every day, you can improve your memory, you can improve your intelligence. So he says, I am that. Then he says, I am Dhriti. Dhriti means fortitude. That means the ability to withstand life's problems. You know, once you determine that this is my goal in life, and then obstacles will come, problems will come. They could be, you know, like in our spiritual studies, you know, or in anything in you do in the world, there can be three kinds of obstacles. And we always chant Shanti, Shanti, Shanti three times, right? When we end anything, like when we end our studies today, we will chant Shanti, Shanti, Shanti three times. Now, why do we chant Shanti three times? Because when we are either, or you could be on your spiritual pursuit, or you could be even in worldly activities, you are starting a new business, or you are studying to go to college, or you are starting a new project, a service project in your community, there can be three kinds of obstacles. One is obstacles from the environment. There could be earthquakes, there could be floods, there could be tornadoes, there could be volcanoes, there could be, you know, tremendous rainfall or no rainfall at all, you know, where there is the crops die. So these are obstacles from the environment and problems. And they can come, earthquake. You know, earthquake can come and destroy the whole town. So that is one obstacle. So the second obstacle is obstacles that come from my surroundings, from my neighbor and my friend or my spouse or my child or my business associates or my boss or my employees. So problems that come from the near and dear ones. So one is problem from the environment, other one is problems in the community. There may be communal riots or, you know, problems between blacks and whites or Muslims and Christians. So those are the second kind of problems. And the third and the most important is problems that come from within. You know, I start out to do some project and I say, I don't think I can do it. You know, I'm not that. You know, so the doubts come, or I sit for meditation and my mind immediately starts running and then I get all these negative thoughts. So they say that when you say Shanti, Shanti, Shanti three times, that, oh Lord, may there be peace in the environment, may there be peace in my surroundings, and may there be peace in my heart. So none of these three problems may affect me. So that's why he says, I am the Dhriti. I am the persistence that regardless of worldly problems, I am able to persist. When you see somebody overcoming all the obstacles and still continuing on his journey, you say this person has a lot of dhriti. And then the last one is kshama, which is translated as forgiveness, also translated as patience. And they are connected, you know, forgiveness and patience. And we find that in the lives of these great saints, where they forgave spontaneously. Why? Because they saw oneness. Just as, you know, I accidentally, you know, poke my finger in my eye, you know. Now, am I going to get mad at my finger and cut it off? No. But if somebody else pokes the finger in my eye, then you bet he's going to hear about it. He's going to hear about it 10 times for 10 days. You remember that day you poked, it still hurts. But if I poke my own finger, I immediately spontaneously forgive the finger and I, you know, massage the eye and put the medicine. So when, why? Because the finger is me and the eye is me. So I spontaneously forgive. But in the lives of these great saints, they see everybody as me. They are all me. I am in them. So they have spontaneous forgiveness and they have infinite patience. So it says, I am all those. Any comments? Yeah, he did not realize. He just said, I do not want to go through this. So is there a way out of it? If there is, I want to find it. And interestingly, Buddha had no guru. He himself, through trial and error, found the path. As you know, first he went and tortured his body. You know, he would for days not eat and he would, you know, became a skeleton, and then he would sit in the heat and the cold and went through tremendous rigorous penance. And then he realized this path is not getting me anywhere. It's only causing more agitation. And then he took the path of moderation, self-control, but not excessive. So through his trial and error, he found that path to nirvana, which he was searching, and took him many, many years. And then he then decided that what I had to go through, I don't want others to go through. So he then became a teacher and traveled throughout the world. And he started out not knowing what he is looking for. He said, I do not want to go through these, what these people are going through, death, old age, suffering, you know, disease. And so I want to find the path. And the driver tells him, sir, your highness, nobody can escape these, including you, your father. And he said, no, I want. So he didn't know what he was looking for, but then he did find them. Yes. Yes, and that is what they say, that the goal of Vedanta is not to change the circumstances, just to change your thinking. You know, it's not going to change your situation in life. Your husband will still be the same, your wife will still be the same, your children, your boss, the weather will still be the same, you know, the communities will still be the same, but the way you look at it will change. So all you have to do is just shift your attention. So Vedanta does not involve changing anything except changing your mind. Like in this whole Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was very confused about his duty. And so Krishna, you know, he was Lord. He could have destroyed all his enemies with one stroke and made him the king. But he said, that's not the purpose. I want you to change your focus. The war will still be the same. Your enemies will still be the same. The situation will still be the same, but he changes thinking. So from the second chapter to the 18th chapter, in the 18th chapter, Arjuna says, my delusion has been removed and I have understood what is my duty. So he teaches him what is the right thing to do, and then you can do whatever you want. So he does not change, the Lord will not change, but if you change the way you think, the same situation will look very different to you. So this Bhagavad Gita just changes, of course, and once you change your vision, then your actions automatically become. Yeah, also, but then he also wanted to teach them the path to go beyond pain and suffering. And that's what he experienced that. No, not only experienced pain, but then he experienced that state of nirvana, and then he understood that I am that consciousness. And the death is only of the body. And the body is just a cloth we put on. Even the Gita, second chapter, Krishna says, Vasamsi Jirnani Yatha Vihai. So just as a person gives up his old clothes, so the individual gives up his body, but nothing happens to him or her. So that is the change. The change is in your thinking. Change is not, whatever time you have to live, you will still live. Whatever the body is, pains will still happen. You will still get old and still have, you know, arthritis and backache and all those problems, but you will realize that I am that consciousness, and the pain is for the body, is not for me. And yeah, I will go and take medicine. If my body is hurting, I'm not going to say, the pain is for the body, I'm not going to do anything. No, I go and take Tylenol or go to the doctor or whatever. But as I watch the body deteriorating, I do not get depressed, because I say, this is nothing. This is just a cloth. If I have to drop it, so what? Nothing happens to me. So these people become fearless. That's why all these great Mahatmas were fearless. No matter how much they were threatened and tortured, they were totally fearless, because they realized that I am that immortal self. And that is the absolute only message that one has to take from the Bhagavad Gita and all the scripture. That is the fundamental message. Of course, there are many other, you know, messages, but that is the number one, that I am that consciousness. I am not this body. And that is what we meditate on also when we sit for meditation. You know, we have a meditation class every Thursday at 6:30. That is exactly what we talk about. And we're actually doing Bhagavad Gita there, chapter 6. Anything else?